It's Ian Pickus, and we're back in the Congressional Corner today with Massachusetts Representative Richard Neal, a Democrat from the 1st District, and he's been in office since 1989. Congressman Neal, welcome back to the program.
Delighted to be with you, Ian.
Well, you know, there's a lot of stuff to talk about, but I want to start actually by offering our condolences. Since the last time we had you on the show, your wife passed away. How's your family doing these days?
Well, thanks for inquiring and offering condolences. We're doing fine. You know that it's always a shock, no matter what people say. And we were very grateful for a very good life for a long time.
It's got to be such an interesting role to be a political spouse. You know, you've obviously been in office for such a long time, and I imagine it takes a lot of sacrifice.
Well, there's no easy way to do it, particularly when you commute back and forth to Washington. Generally, you're gone 3 or 4 days a week, and I think that there's always this notion that the people that reside here think they should be living back in their districts, and the people who are living in their districts want to be able to spend more time here. There simply is no easy accommodation, and the formula has to be one that is satisfied by the families. I think even though we in Massachusetts have a relatively short commute, it nonetheless requires you to be here for often all hours of the day and night.
While we're talking about such heady stuff, what was your reaction to the news of President Biden's diagnosis?
Well, obviously, we want to send our best to him at a very difficult time. At the same time, I think that some of the information that has been passed on to all of us, there seems to be a bit of conflict into what the actual disease means in terms of longevity for him. I think Joe Biden's a very decent guy. I actually think he did a very good job as president. And I think that there's considerable disagreement now about some of the health care matters. But I also think there'll be an opportunity for doctors to better explain it rather than pundits.
It's coming at a very interesting time when there are these books coming out about, you know, President Biden's status last year and that kind of thing. Are you worried that the questions over his health and the decision to run for a second term will overshadow what he did accomplish during those years?
I think that's the case in the moment in which we live. I'm not sure that'll be the case as people have a better chance and historians have a better opportunity to reflect upon the accomplishments. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find a period of time for a one-term president to accomplish more, including pandemic relief, the Butch-Lewis Act, postal reform, the WEP Act, and not to miss what we did with the infrastructure bill, the CHIPS Act. Those are just a few of the pieces of legislation that he signed, and I'm very proud of the Inflation Reduction Act in particular because it's the most important climate legislation in the history of the world, and I helped write the major parts of it, and Joe Biden signed the legislation. We also had a very strong working relationship with him. I had known him for a long period of time. And I think that at the moment, there remains great controversy. But I also think that if that's the case, there ought to be some reflection upon President Trump's health. I think that we're just simply talking about Biden's health as though it's in the rearview mirror. And I think that reflecting on the health reports in the past that some doctors said they diagnosed by watching TV ought to be part of equal scrutiny.
So you think that President Trump might not also, I don't want to say also there, I guess, but President Trump might not be telling the full picture about how he's doing.
I don't know, but I don't understand why a current president would spend so much time on a former president. There has always been a certain element of courtesies that were extended from president to former president and from former presidents to current presidents. And I bring attention to that because I recall one of the better statements, and I disagreed with George W. Bush frequently, but I thought that after Barack Obama had become president, I thought it was interesting when President Bush said, I owe him my silence.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of the present day, there's this, quote, big, beautiful bill making its way through your chamber. Maybe. I don't know when people will actually hear this conversation, so things are changing pretty quickly. But first of all, just a big picture. You know, it's an 1,100-page bill. What are your thoughts about the package?
Well, it's a big, beautiful billionaire's tax cut. That's what it really is. The Ways and Means Committee, which I'm the leading Democrat, we spent 18 hours a week ago clearly not only scrutinizing the bill, but drafting the contrasts that we offer through the amendment process. When you look at the distribution tables here, which are probably the Bible of tax policy. It lays out who gets what. And people that make a lot of money, people that are making more than $1 million a year, for example, they're going to get considerable tax relief. People that make under $30,000 a year, not so much. So I think that the number for somebody over $1 million is close to $90,000. And for the person at under $50,000, I think it's closer to like $1 a day.
Now, as you say, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, scored the bill and said the bottom 10% would actually lose household resources and the top 10% would gain household resources. So my question is, isn't that bad politics?
Well, it is bad politics, but there's a pathology of the modern Republican Party, and that is that all tax cuts are good. And I think it gets in the way of some of the previous theology of the Republican Party, which has now been debunked clearly and everywhere, that tax cuts pay for themselves. But that doesn't stop them here any longer. What they're essentially saying with this legislation is that you can borrow $4 trillion and add it to the national debt. In 2017, they borrowed $2.3 trillion for the purpose of giving a tax cut. I think that because they've always tried to present themselves as the party of fiscal rectitude, it's fascinating that they complain about the national debt on Monday, and then by the middle of the week, they're planning to add $4 trillion to it, all of it borrowed money.
You told one outlet that you've had conversations with Republican members who acknowledge that this package could be bad for them. I mean, it does have a lot of cuts in it, too. How widespread is that feeling as Speaker Johnson tries to hold this coalition together?
Well, I don't know how widespread it is, but I can tell you it's certainly on their minds because it has been noted to me. In addition to which, people understand very clearly from the Congressional Budget Office that when you plan to cut $850 billion from Medicaid, which is really important to North Adams Hospital, really important to Berkshire Medical Center, as well as the hospitals in the Pioneer Valley, you are drawing a conclusion. And the conclusion is that people that make a lot of money are going to get a big tax cut. And people who are on Medicaid, for example, they're going to see their health benefits cut, if not suspended. Our hospitals are at least two-thirds dependent on Medicare and Medicaid for revenue. When you, again, you look at the formula, we don't have the scale that Boston has where they can negotiate what is known as private pay, the result of which is that we are much dependent on Medicaid and Medicare, and our hospitals are now our biggest employers. They seem to have conveniently forgotten that. And a lot of hospitals in red states also could close because of what they plan to do. So they're really carving up nutrition programs, and they're carving up health care for the purpose of giving a tax cut to wealthy people. That is not to be denied.
Now, we just have a minute left for today's conversation, but President Trump was on the Hill and he was meeting with the House GOP conference. And according to reporting, he said not to cut Medicaid, I mean, which was a huge part of this bill. What was your reaction to that news?
I think if you put that in context, he was saying not to cut it further than what had already been agreed to by the Republican conference. Mm-hmm. I think that's the better answer, because you can't look at this proposal from the White House that the Republicans have embraced and almost written in tandem with the White House and not come to the conclusion health care is going to get cut.
Congressman Neal, we were talking about this big House package. And as we speak, Speaker Johnson is trying to hold together that narrow GOP majority. The relative moderates want one thing. The Freedom Caucus wants another thing. My question is, assuming that they are able to pass this at some point soon, do you think it will be substantially altered in the Senate?
For sure. And I'm ever so hopeful that those in the Senate will come to a different conclusion than those in the House. I think some of that might be buffered by the fact that many of them might not be in a reelect cycle over there. So that will give them greater opportunity for deliberation. I think many of them have already said that this proposal that's coming from the House Republicans has very little chance of passing the U.S. Senate. And I think that it's very important to understand that if you're a Republican senator from Missouri, one out of three people in your state derives a Medicaid benefit. In West Virginia, I think it's closer to 40%, and they have Republican senators. So this legislation has not been thought through carefully. It's the zeal that they've embraced to get it done, which should be bothersome to everybody. As we speak, we debated the Republicans for 18 hours in the Ways and Means Committee. Much of it was done in the dark of night after I had written to the chairman of the committee asking that it be done during the day so people could actually dial in, stream, or whatever would allow them to get the debate to present it in public. And all night long, again, at the Rules Committee, they're still at it over there, but they went back and forth during those hours when people just aren't watching or paying a lot of attention. I think they're ashamed of the legislation. They know the contours of this means a huge addition to the national debt, and yet they seem to be marching forward because Donald Trump showed up again yesterday and intimidated them into their conclusion.
I heard your colleague from Massachusetts, the ranking member on that Rules Committee, Jim McGovern, saying, you know, why are we doing this at 1 in the morning? And the answer from one of his GOP colleagues was, well, we've got a long history of doing things all night long on the Rules Committee. But to be fair, I didn't hear that until the morning to prove your point, you know.
Well, I actually talked to Jim about this, and I sent over a copy of the letter that I sent to Chairman Smith on the Ways and Means Committee asking that the precedent that I had established when I was chairman, that the legislation would be written during the daylight hours. And if we got to 8 o'clock during the evening, we would simply adjourn and come back the next morning. I think that's the way you want to do this, so the public has a chance to digest all of the particulars and to draw their own conclusions. And the decision of the Republican Party to do this in the dark of night, I think, once again, indicates that they are uncomfortable with this legislation, knowing then it comes to the benefit of very wealthy people at the expense of those at the lower end of the economic spectrum.
Governor Healey put out a statement from her office about the state's inability to make up for the cuts to programs in this bill, like SNAP and Medicaid. Have you had many conversations with the governor about what kind of shape the state will be in if this goes forward?
Yes, I talked to her 3 or 4 weeks ago about this, and I did point out that clearly the state will not be able to compensate for the cuts as it relates to Medicaid expenditure. Medicaid, as intended by President Johnson when he signed the legislation, and we're all grateful for what he did, was supposed to be for those deemed at the time to be poor. Well, it has also evolved into a middle-class benefit in the sense that it provides a lot of long-term care across America. And I think that the governor wisely is suggesting that you cannot make up these cuts with the state budget. And certainly, it would be near impossible to include the startling statistic that we should be heralding, and that is that every child in Massachusetts has health insurance because of the Affordable Care Act. It's because of the expansion of Medicaid. The states, because it's generally a 50-50, sometimes 60-40 allocation between the federal government and the state government, means that the state governments across the country surely cannot make up the difference.
So I know you touched on this a little bit in terms of Medicaid, but what will the impacts on nutrition program cuts be like in your first district?
Well, we've done an analysis of it, and they're going to be pretty devastating. I think we've pointed out that in a country that has been blessed with the bounty we have, with a spectacular farm system, high-quality food, that providing for those who need food should be a basic obligation of the federal government. And there are a lot of people that take advantage now of these opportunities who never thought in a million years they would need to do that. So I think food security is a very big issue. The food bank is but one good example, I think, of where we've even had a chance to have significant influence on an initiative that has worked quite well. And the other part of it is that it's important to lore as well that it was George McGovern and Bob Dole who expanded the nutrition programs across the country because they both came from rural farming states, understanding that urban legislators would be supportive and that rural farmers would be supportive. It was a very, very handsome concept, and it has worked quite well. And they should not be going back and saying simply that we're going to cut nutrition programs again so that we can cut taxes for very wealthy people.
Now, what about President Trump's argument that, you know, people have gotten used to the Trump tax cuts from the first term, and so this would represent, if they are not continued in this bill, a huge shock to people, you know, paying more?
Well, again, if you look at the distribution tables, the president is probably championing what the allocation was for people at the top. This proposal also reminds me that in 2017, for all his talk, in 2017, they borrowed $2.3 trillion for that tax cut. There isn't one Republican who will deny what I've just said. And they didn't have the sort of economic growth. They didn't allow these tax cuts to pay for themselves because there was no mathematical conclusion that would have allowed that in the beginning once you consider the interest that you have to pay on top of the borrowing that was done. So, again, it's nothing more than theology that they've embraced as it relates to tax cuts paying for themselves. They did not occur.
Have you been surprised that Speaker Johnson has been able to remain in that post the way he has, given what happened with his predecessor, Kevin McCarthy, and you know the fact that those factions are still there?
Well, I think one of the things that is important to remember is that the Speaker of the House does whatever the president tells him to do. I've been here for a lot of speakers. I can tell you it's the first time I've ever seen it to this degree. Speakers, as the term implies, they're the leader of a separate branch of government, the House of Representatives and the legislative branch therein. And for Johnson to roll over every time Trump tells him that he's got to do this or he's got to do that, this is not negotiating between the two of them. It's not deliberation. It's you're doing this. And I think Johnson fears that if Trump said that, look, if you don't do this, I will call for the Republicans to replace you in the House, they would go along with Trump.
I just have a minute left in today's segment, but you've actually had an experience that many Americans haven't. You've been on Air Force One. What was your reaction to the news that we're going to get a new Air Force One from Qatar?
Bad idea. And I think that clearly it's going to cost a lot more money because it's going to have to be revamped for security purposes. And I think the idea that America can't provide Air Force One plane, it strikes me as being disingenuous, as the president alleges that it's a free plane that's coming from Qatar. And the way this was done, if you look at the New York Times analysis, this was in the planning stages for a long time. This wasn't just an act of friendship as the president arrived there. This has been going on for a while.
So, you know, there's been all this conversation in Washington about cuts to the social safety net between DOGE and the big House bill with the president's domestic agenda. And it leaves me wondering, where is the future of Social Security given all of these changes?
Well, part of the challenge we have is they're closing Social Security offices. You have many senior citizens that they need personal contact if they were to visit a Social Security office so they could verify their presence, ask questions of the appropriate agent, and then have their questions satisfactorily answered. Social Security is an extraordinarily efficient initiative. When Elon Musk said there are 300-year-olds getting Social Security, that was crazy conversation. And then they went on to say that there were 200-year-olds that were claiming Social Security. I've never heard such nonsense. And I look back at Social Security, the fraud ratio in Social Security is less than 0.1%. It's astounding how successful Social Security has been. And members of Congress, we know that whenever there's a question that comes from a constituent about Social Security, we promptly get them an answer. We've just had success with the WEP program. That's another example of how people who had put in the necessary quarters waited for a long time, but we were able to get it done. I've been a champion of that legislation for 20 years, continuing to file bills until it was done. President Biden singled me out at the White House for the achievement. And a reminder that many of those checks have already been deposited to Social Security benefits that were entitled to them. So I think that Social Security is the greatest anti-poverty program in the history of the world. I think the other part of Social Security is its great efficiencies. And when Musk says things like it's a Ponzi scheme, that implies that it's illicit or illegal or unlawful. Again, I don't know where they come up with these statements that bear no responsibility for what they're saying.
What have been some of the impacts of Musk and DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, in Massachusetts that you're aware of?
Well, first of all, he said that he was going to cut $2 trillion from these different initiatives. Well, it's closer to about $150 billion. And he says now he's changed his tune. He's leaving the scene in Washington. He apparently is moving back to managing Tesla. But how about the idea that I met with veterans recently in Ludlow, Massachusetts, And those veterans were saying, well, guess what? We're now getting a telehealth physical exam that takes 10 minutes from somebody who's located in Boston or Connecticut. And that's the ideal that Musk and these guys have embraced. The cutbacks that they've proposed, locking people out of their offices, kind of haphazardly telling them that they no longer work at these agencies, only to have the federal courts overturn these decisions. People who have given their lives and their careers in the Veterans Administration and others just being summarily laid off or shown the door or locked out. I think you're going to hear people out there say, well, this had to be done. Well, it didn't have to be done this way. And I think it's been very cruel. And in addition, I think a lot of people are losing services that they thought that they had earned. And my position on this has been very clear. And that is that I think that Musk and Doge are way out of line. You've got some 19-year-old kid scrutinizing Social Security disability benefits. That's a violation of our right to privacy. And I hope that people, as they have a chance to reflect about what's being done here, they will continue to suggest that this is unlawful, as the courts have deemed it, but it's also immoral for the way that these people have been treated.
You know, I was wondering about that, because when the president reached the 100-day benchmark, there were a lot of public polls associated with that milestone, and they showed that, you know, Musk and Doge were not really popular, and the president's popularity had taken a hit. But my question is whether that translates in any way to how things unfold in Washington. I mean, you know, it's GOP control, and they sort of ran on shaking things up this way.
Well, every time that there's been a big tax cut, dating back to Ronald Reagan's years that the Republicans have proposed, every time there's been that big tax cut, Democrats have won the House of Representatives. And I think that's surely to happen again this time around. And it's because I don't think that they're well thought out. I think that they distribute tax cuts to people, again, who don't need them. And I also think that what's important to take into consideration here is that it's the arbitrary nature of what was done here. You have people from Doge in the private sector who might have business interests just showing up at these federal agencies and ordering people to turn over their laptops, ordering people to turn over their phones, and locking them out. I don't understand that for the life of me. And the other thing that is very consistent with the Trump administration has been there's a lot of bluster early in the morning. There's generally retreat in the afternoon, and then you get around to the declaration of victory always. It's exemplified by these tariffs that have been imposed. We are not winning the tariff battle as has been suggested. Canada has been a longtime ally and friend. Western Europe, Eastern Europe, they've been with us. They've stood with us in war and peace. And all of a sudden, they're being pushed away, and we're voting with North Korea and Russia at the United Nations. I hope people come to grips with what's really happening.
So given that, you know, the next midterm is always right around the corner, what do you think the Democratic Party's message should be to voters who really rejected them in the last race?
Well, I think we should point out that it's the constant chaos. And now to ill-considered many of these policy changes have been. And again, the harm that's done oftentimes is psychological as well as monetary. I think that when people have a chance to reflect upon what's happened during these just 100 days, if they want more of this chaos, which I don't think they do, they have a choice and a chance next year to do something about it.
Back to Massachusetts real quick. Some GOP candidates for governor have emerged. Do you think that Governor Healey is in any trouble when it comes to her reelection bid in 2026?
No, I don't. I think she's done a really good job. I'm a fan of the governor. I think she's chosen many just moderate positions. It's very hard to be the executive. You know, you have to choose when you're the executive. You don't get to lay out esoteric arguments. You don't get to put on a lot of seminars. And you have to actually effectuate governance. And I think in the case of Maura Healey, she's done a really nice job. She's a frequent visitor to all of us in Western Massachusetts. I talk with her with great regularity. And yes, I think that many times she's accepted some of the advice that I've offered.
And so the GOP candidates you've seen so far, I mean, it's possible we had Governor Baker for two terms. So a Republican can win there. You've talked about the Route 495 corridor as being really important, but you think she's still pretty popular in Massachusetts?
Yeah, I do. I mean, 495, that beltway there, they, you know, and I represented it for a long time. I've got a pretty good feel for what the voters think out there. And in that 499 beltway, they really don't land as Democrats or Republicans anymore. These are overwhelmingly suburban independent voters. They tend to come down on the liberal side on social policy, certainly a bit more moderate to conservative on fiscal policy. But they are the ones that drive these statewide elections now. And people that run statewide, they know that.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk politics, both local and national, with you, Congressman Richard Neal of the 1st District of Massachusetts, a Democrat in office since 1989. We'll let you go vote, and best of luck down there.
Thanks very much, Ian.